The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic and the News and Observer. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. Now, these are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. On today's Armchair Traveler, we're going to begin by exploring the mystery of the rings. Now, writer Verminique Greenwood's article appeared in the February 2025 issue of National Geographic. As one photo caption explains, when hundreds of eerily perfect circles were discovered on the ocean floor, theories abounded about what they could mean. Now, 4 years of underwater research revealed a lost world. Now, this caption overlays a two-page color photo of the Mediterranean Sea, and there's a second caption that we'll read. Nearly 400 feet beneath the Mediterranean Sea, over 1,300 unexplained rings were found etched across the seafloor. Now, we're going to turn the page, and we find a second two-page brightly colored photo with this caption. While investigating the origin of the rings, photographer Laurent Ballesta and his team found a riot of colorful sea life, including yellow coral that is seldom seen by divers in the Mediterranean. Now we're going to the main story for more. On a bright, hot day in mid-September 2011, a marine biologist named Christine Pergent-Martini was hunkered down inside the cabin of a small research vessel, a 97-foot-long catamaran, cruising through the Mediterranean Sea about 12 miles off the coast of Corsica. Outside the ship's windows, the sun glinted off the dark blue water, but Pergent-Martini ignored the waves. She was more interested in what lay beneath them. A monitor in front of her displayed images from the vessel's onboard sonar system, which was emitting a series of short acoustic pulses to reveal the underwater topography about 400 feet below. The ocean scientist was nearing the last day of a month-long mission, with a small crew including her husband, oceanographer Gerard Pergent, and a graduate student from the University of Corsica, Pasquale Paoli, Pergent-Martini, had been mapping the seafloor in this region. The seemingly simple goal actually targeted one of oceanography's major blind spots. The Mediterranean Sea covers about 1 million square miles, stretching from the Strait of Gibraltar in the west to Lebanon in the east. While its surface has been traversed since ancient times by everything from Greek triremes to Etruscan warships, its depths are mysterious to modern science. Much of its seafloor exists in something of a liminal zone, too shallow and close to the shore to draw interest from deep-sea mining companies, but still too deep to be reachable by conventional scuba divers. Pergent-Martini and her colleagues wanted to learn more about what lived at the bottom of these depths. At first, the day was no different from any other. As the boat moved across the water, the scientists watched a series of predictable, grainy black-and-white images appear on the screen. Sand, small rocks, more sand. It was all stuff they'd seen before, but then something truly bizarre scrolled into view. A perfect circle, then another. They were all about the same size, around 67 feet in diameter, with a distinct outline and striking symmetry. Weirder still, almost every ring had a dark spot directly in the center. They looked like fried eggs, Pergent-Martini thought, and there appeared to be several dozen of them. The scientists looked at each other. We had no idea what it was, Pergent-Martini says. Her team carefully logged their location and used a remotely operated vehicle to gather images. Still, the mystery only deepened. They captured video footage of the circles, but the view was too murky to confirm much more than the fact this wasn't sunken cargo. Now, when the researchers presented their findings at a 2013 scientific meeting, they were still in search of answers about the nature of the rings. Even a follow-up study with the submarine in 2014 didn't answer all their questions. In time, researchers would count more than 1,300 of these circles over a nearly 6-square-mile area. After years of applying for grants to study the rings more closely, the Purgents reached a dead end. It was very difficult to obtain money, Purgent Martini said. The Purgents are specialists in seagrass meadows, and this was a bit outside their focus. We had no way to go farther. Then, just the right person got in touch. In the world of undersea exploration, Lorraine Ballesta is known for going the extremes, a photographer, marine biologist, and technical diver. He co-runs Andromeda Oceanology, a company that leads scientific missions to document some of the world's most inaccessible places. These undertakings often require specialized equipment and elaborate dive plans. In Antarctica, for instance, he once used a bespoke system of cables to photograph the underside of an iceberg. In South Africa, he has explored deep underwater caves to capture images of rare coelacanths, which were thought to be extinct for millions of years before small, fragile populations were rediscovered. And in French Polynesia, he's used a customized rebreather system to stay underwater for 24 hours at a time to observe the hunting habits of gray reef sharks, as chronicled in a 2018 story for National Geographic. Ballesta and his team are always on the hunt for the next target. He has also had connections to the Purgents. He studied them while working toward his master's degree. So when he read his former teacher's scientific paper about the mysterious pockmarked sonar scans, he was riveted. Some organisms have been known to grow in circular formations. Corals make atolls, for example. But these rings repeated with an eerie regularity. How is this possible, he remembers thinking. Perhaps there were craters caused by erupting underwater vents or strange geological formation. Purgent Martini and her husband had a different hunch. Based on their submersible explorations, they believed the rings were coralline algae growing in a previously unknown shape. Another theory put forth by some scientists was that they were craters left by unused World War II bombs jettisoned by U.S. planes returning to their bases on Corsica. With the Purgents' approval, Ballesta decided to pick up where they'd left off in hopes of solving the mystery using their data to locate the rings. In July 2020, Ballesta and two other divers from Andromeda Oceanology arrived above the rings in their own research vessel, donned scuba gear to descend into the abyss. While they were quickly sinking to the bottom, they stayed there only about 30 minutes because they had to account for at least several hours of decompression. That's the time they have to take on the way back to the surface. Equipped with a waterproof camera and lights, the team swam down through the bright upper waters of the ocean, the daylight gradually dimming to twilight. In less than 2 minutes, they were approaching their destination, nearly 400 feet below the waves. I stopped before I reached the bottom, some 20 or 30 meters up, says Ballesta, because I saw the rings. They loomed out of the darkness, alien, enormous. They resembled gigantic platters etched onto the seafloor. After he snapped some photos, Ballesta dived to the bottom and approached one ring. At its center was a large knob made by a red calcareous algae, measuring around 3 feet high and several feet across, with swaying fan-like growths atop it. The knob was surrounded by a vast wasteland of pale, scree-like debris, and the slightly downhill, about 30 feet beyond the center, was the dark outer ring, a circular perimeter that appeared to be made up of rotoliths, a collection of craggy, firm, pebble-sized algae. Looking at the structure, Ballesta realized that the Purgents were right. It was alive, he says. After 27 minutes on the bottom, Ballesta and his crew spent nearly 5 hours gradually rising to decompress safely, allowing their bodies to equalize to the shifting pressure. Long before he got back to the boat, Ballesta was convinced he had to return. I didn't need 27 minutes, he says, about his time on the seafloor. After the first minute, I knew. Julie Detter a marine ecologist who was waiting for them, for the team, back on the ship deck, saw the excitement on their faces the moment they surfaced. Usually, by the time divers complete their long, monotonous ascent, the thrill is faded, but they were still very marked by what they had seen, she says. There was still no explanation for why the rotoliths would have formed such perfect circles so many times over. Ballesta decided he needed to spend more time among the rings, which would require a way to stay longer in the depths. In July 2021, Ballesta returned to the waters north of Corsica with three divers, Roberto Rinaldi, Tribal Robi, and Antonin Gilbert, and a bold plan that would give them more time for exploration on the seafloor. They were inspired by divers on oil rigs who can quickly travel back and forth to the ocean bottom. At the surface, these rig divers live in sealed pressurized chambers that match the conditions beneath the sea, where the pressure can increase by 10 or more times. They can then rapidly ascend and descend in a diving bell without having to slowly adjust to the change in pressure. Inside their own chamber at the surface, Ballesta and others would live a bit like astronauts. Food would be passed through an airlock. When they were ready to descend, they'd suit up and squeeze into the diving bell that would take them down to the seabed. The team had expected to spend 3 weeks exploring the rings and nearby reefs, but the weather turned against them. Heavy wind and waves rocked the boat, leaving the chamber dangerous on several occasions. For multiple days, the four men were trapped, unable to see out of their increasingly humid chamber, which barely held their small beds and dining table. Ballesta's voice turns bitter as he recalls this period. Time for exploration was precious, and they were spending it reading novels. Finally, the weather shifted, offering them the chance to drop down through the elevator chamber. We found ourselves in another universe, says Gilbert. This time, the crew could spend hours exploring it. All around, the divers marveled at the abundance of life. As they made more dives, when weather conditions allowed, they found rarely seen yellow corals in the deep canyons. There were also squat lobsters and colorful small fish hiding among pale pink gorgonians, a sort of fan-like soft coral that's often seen in the Mediterranean canyons. At one point, Ballesta spotted a blue sea slug wandering about and took a photo. It was the first still photo taken of this species by a diver. Ballesta invited the Pergents to monitor their progress aboard the support ship. They looked very happy and touched that their discovery made this project happen, he says. Because of the Pergents' work, he and his colleagues were exploring a pristine and unusual ecosystem. But Ballesta knew this little universe was in a precarious position. It existed under shipping lanes, and commercial ships dropping anchor could pulverize everything. Anchors can destroy all the rings very easily, Ballesta says. The threat fueled a sense of urgency. The more they could learn about the rings, the better chance Ballesta might have of getting French authorities to protect them. Ballesta and his team made a total of 6 descents from their pressurized chamber to the rings. They focused their attention on drilling cores of the ring's central knobs, which were then sent for carbon dating and analysis. The hope was that knowing the ring's age could help solve the mystery of what formed them and how. When the results came back, the team was shocked. The most ancient material deep in the center of the knobs was about 21,000 years old. For those who study climate history, that particular era represents a moment of profound planetary change. It's the last glacial maximum, says paleoclimatologist Edward Bard of the Collège de France, who organized the carbon dating. That was the peak of the last ice age. Back then, the Mediterranean was colder and far shallower, and the place where the rings are today would have been less than 65 feet from the surface, bathed in sunlight. In the summer of 2023, Ballesta returned to the rings, this time with a support vessel capable of launching 2 submarines to allow ocean and climate experts, including Bard, to make their own extended voyages into the ecosystem. The effort, which received funding from the National Geographic Society, was intended to form a rigorous hypothesis, of exactly how the circles emerged. On one dive, Ballesta swam alongside the submersible as it scooted above the seabed. Acting as a tour guide, he showed the scientists inside various aspects of the rings and their surroundings. There were underwater caves nearby set into a small cliff. The divers had found several caverns with layers of sediment and confirmed the area had once been situated above the ancient coastline. The voids may have been the first cut through erosion as water washed against the cliff some 21,000 years ago. Near the end of the trip, the scientists retreated to the ship's cabin, hooked up to the glitchy internet. Bard and the others were reading papers, looking at maps, thinking over what they had seen. Slowly, over the next few months, they put together a hypothesis. Even though, to an expert, the knobs in the center of the rings might look like coral, they were not. They were deposits formed by coralline algae, photosynthetic organisms that create skeletons made of calcium carbonate. During the last ice age, thousands of these algae colonies likely took root on what was then a very sunny seafloor. For 3,000 years or so, these algae flourished, growing outward like domes or pancakes, measuring several yards. Then around 20,000 years ago, the world began to warm and continental ice sheets began to melt, funneling into the Mediterranean, which rose until the sun-loving algae were drowned into darkness. Their domes collapsed, leaving only the central knobs and bits of calcium carbonate scattered like bones from a carcass around them. For thousands of years, nothing lived amid the remains that left a permanent imprint. But about 8,000 years ago, the sea level stabilized. Deep water algae laid down new layers on the central knobs, creating the film of life the divers saw. At the same time, rhododendron algae started to encase broken bits of calcium. The nuggets of algae rolled downhill from the knobs, settling around the base of the cones in perfect circles. That's everyone's best guess. The simple tug of gravity formed the rings. We don't have all the proof, admits Ballesta, but we have nothing to say that our history is wrong. Protecting the entire field of rings may prove difficult. Only about one-third of them lie within the Cape Corse and the Agriet Marine National Park, a French marine protected area. But the park, with the help of Ballesta's Andromeda Oceanology, is taking on this challenge. Using data from Ballesta's dives, it plans to advocate for the further protection of all rings, even those located outside its bounds, in French and Italian waters. The park's management council will propose prohibiting the anchoring of commercial vessels in the area. Normally, with this type of regulation, it takes years, Ballesta says, but because so many of the rings already exist within a conservation zone, he is optimistic. He's also no longer thinking just about the rings, but about what they represent. Traces like these, signs of the ancient coastline, including rings, submerged caves, and other mysterious structures may be hidden all around the ocean floor. They are places for studying how the world is always building something new on the husk of a previous age. While there have been no sightings of the rings elsewhere, you have to realize that explorations at this depth have been rare in the Mediterranean Sea, Pergent Martini says. Perhaps there are others that have not yet been discovered. What a story, huh? Well, also in the February 2025 issue of the National Geographic is a brief article and some photos with the title, Ghost of the Guano Islands. Now, this is written by Thomas Peschek, and as the editors tell us, in Peru, a photographer finds a novel way to pay homage to seabirds that were lost. Now, we're going to read a short article, and then we're going to take a look at some photo captions for Peschek's story. In the beginning of this article, briefly reads, in the 19th century, ships full of workers sailed to islands off the coast of Peru to mine a precious resource, bird excrement or guano, deposited by seabirds like cormorants, pelicans, and boobies. The chalky white material was sold as fertilizer to farmers around the world, but as environmental cost. As trade increased, more people disturbed the birds' habitat, contributing to severe population declines on the border of tens of millions. The steep drop in numbers inspired photographer and National Geographic explorer Thomas Peschek to resurrect the ghost of seabirds passed into the modern-day landscape, he says. In these archival photographs, he projects images onto now-diminished areas of the islands to share a unique perspective of the seabird crisis. And by the way, Alanis Zakos wrote the introduction. And in our first caption, we read, using the inexpensive solar-powered equipment, Peschek projected monochrome historical images onto the modern landscape of Isla Guanape Norte. Or Isla Guanape Norte, more precisely. And you see these interesting rock formations and some dwellings, and he projects this on these rock formations to allow, and you can see all these birds. I mean, just dozens, too many to count. Some very interesting artistic work here. Now, our next photo is describing brutal conditions. Guano mining was not only an environmental concern, but also a humanitarian tragedy. During the 1800s, many workers were indentured servants or prisoners forced to use pickaxes to collect the excrement. The backdrop for this archival image is Isla Guanape Norte. And you see the isle with the sea, and then projected onto that how the miners and the people, or harvesters, were gathering all this guano. And then finally, there's a photo. And this photo is called Hauling Guano. Guano harvesting ships are displayed on stacked bags of recently gathered excrement on Isle Isha. Now, today, guano mining is still profitable, though highly regulated. The islands and their birds are protected by Peru's government. And then our final caption on the last page is a two-page. It almost looks like a monastery or a church. And they've got a projection on the backside of this building. It's called Feeding the Flock. An abundance of anchovies once supported huge numbers of birds, such as these pelicans, projected onto an abandoned building on Isle Lobos de Afuera. Overfishing contributed to the birds' decline. So quite a story there, right? Well, let's conclude our journey today with a little expedition closer to home. As you may recall, Hurricane Helene left widespread devastation throughout much of western North Carolina, and this was only last fall. Now, in some cases, whole communities were washed away by raging floodwaters, and this included many small bridges that were swept away, leaving some communities cut off from primary roads. High winds and falling trees, along with mudslides, added to the damage, which included homes, stores, and other buildings. A large part of the damage occurred in and around the Asheville area. Restoration continues, and there's a lot of work still to be done. And there are forecasts indicating it could be months or even years before all the restoration is completed. One of the effects involved hiking trails used by many visitors to that region. In the February 7, 2025 online edition of the News and Observer, writer Martha Quillen reported that sections of North Carolina's Appalachian Trail and the Mountains to Sea Trail finally reopened after Helene and this was again online on February 7th. And by the way, I said Appalachia or Appalachian Trail. There are people who say it should be pronounced Appalachian Trail. Why the difference? Locals call it Appalachia, so we will prefer or defer to the local pronunciation. The Carolina Mountain Club brought 130 volunteers in November 2024 to help clear debris left by Hurricane Helene off the Appalachian Trail and the French Broad River in the town of Hot Springs. Some recovery work in the North Carolina mountains since Hurricane Helene has happened to be off the beaten path. Volunteers and government crews repair damage on the Appalachian Trail and Mountain to Sea Trail. Both popular trails still have some closures, but as the weather warms and the outdoor beckons, trail managers say it's safe for hikers to venture back into the woods. The key is to check the most up-to-date information on which trail sections are opened or closed and what conditions they're in. And then she goes on to provide a little more information about that. Along the Appalachian Trail, damage on the AT in North Carolina and Tennessee was extensive from Helene's landslides and washouts, along with high winds that dropped trees across the path. This time of year, the 3,000 or so people who thru-hiked the AT from Georgia to Maine are finalizing their plans, but some 3 million people use the trail each year for shorter jaunts. Franklin Tate, the Appalachian Trail Conservancy's Associate Regional Director in the South, said on February 2nd that volunteers from hiking clubs have performed nearly 10,000 hours of work on the AT since Helene hit September 27th. Most of the work so far has been by volunteers from 2 clubs, he said, the Tennessee Eastman Hiking and Canoeing Club and the Carolina Mountain Club. When they first started, he said, you would walk a mile or two and everything would be great. Then you'd round a corner and there'd be 100 trees across the trail. In some places, the storm turned the forest into what Tate called jackstraw timber, piled as high as your head. Where volunteers can work with chainsaws, he said, they are clearing swath every several feet and several feet wide along the treadway, giving hikers some breathing room. In designated wilderness areas where chainsaws are not allowed, the work has to be done with crosscut saws. And a crosscut saw is no joke. And they describe this by saying, picture an old cartoon saw with one blade and 2 lumberjacks, each one ripping it back and forth. It's a slower, definitely more laborious process. Are tourists welcome in towns in the Appalachian Trail? Well, those who make a living off mountain tourism are happy to see the trail being rebuilt, Tate said. In Asheville, Hot Springs, and other towns that cater to hikers, many restaurants, hotels, and Airbnbs have reopened. Road repair work in the mountains is still underway. The North Carolina Department of Transportation has established detours where necessary. The Hot Springs Resort and Spa has announced it will reopen to guests on February 14th and is accepting reservations. And in following up on that, I found nothing to negate that, so apparently that did happen. As we record this story, it's a little later than February the 14th. Now, will the Appalachian Trail, or what will it be like before Helene, or will it be like that? And Tate said crews should be able to restore most of the trail to its pre-Helene route, though some temporary detours may be required. One of those would be getting the trail across the Nolichucky River outside Irwin, Tennessee. Before Helene, the trail crossed the river using the Chostoa Bridge, but that was wiped out by flooding on the Nolichucky. Now, planners have blazed a 3.5-mile detour, but Tate and the Conservancy has raised money through its resiliency fund to be able to use to engage a ferry operator to take hikers across the river. If it works out, he said, the ferry should be in place in the spring. Carolina Mountain Club volunteers helped clear down trees along the French Broad River near Hot Springs in December 2024. And the town relies on tourism, especially hikers along the Appalachian Trail, he said. And that's a quote from David Huff of the Carolina Mountain Trail. Now, what sections are open? Well, the Appalachian Trail Conservancy regularly updates its interactive map on the status of the trail. And the U.S. Forest Service also updates trail information through its webpage for the Appalachian Ranger District, and that includes the areas hardest hit by Helene. And the Forest Service has announced that 114 miles of the Appalachian Trail within Pisgah National Forest from I-40 to Indian Grave Gap, that's around milepost 241.3 to 351.8, that traverses Haywood, Madison, and Yancey counties, as well as Hughes Gap to Calvers Gap to Daw Flats in Mitchell and Avery counties. The Forest Service has also opened other trails that were damaged by the storm. So if you're thinking about a hike or visiting the area, there you go. Some updated information. Just check out those websites for the latest. That's it for today's Journey in Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.